And it was true that, like all inspiring companies, AOL set in motion changes that profoundly altered how we do almost everything. They inspired a nation to get online. Their cause was clear, and their decisions were governed by their why. Their goal was to get more people online, even if their decisions in the pursuit of that goal wreaked havoc on their business in the short term. With their why in focus, AOL pulled ahead of their competition by deciding to change from hourly pricing for internet access to unlimited monthly pricing, a decision that created so much traffic, it shut down their servers. Given the impact, the decision was neither practical nor rational, but it was the right choice to help bring their cause to life. That their systems shut down with all that additional traffic only pushed them to work harder to cope with it, to ensure that America could, in fact, get and stay online. In those days, having an AOL email address was a point of pride, a sign of being one of those who was part of an internet revolution. These days, still having an AOL email address is a symbol of being left behind. That the meaning of something as simple as @AOL.com has changed so dramatically is additional proof that the company's cause has long since departed. Absent a clear why, size and momentum are all AOL has to keep them going. The company is not inspiring anymore, not to those who work there and not to those on the outside. We don't talk about them like we used to, and we certainly don't feel the same way about them either. We don't compare them to Google or Facebook or any of the other industry-changing companies today. Like a massive freight train with brakes applied, it will still take miles for this train to come to a complete stop. It's simple physics. At best, AOL size will help them putter along. But without a more compelling purpose, cause, or belief, the company is simply a collection of stuff. It will probably end up being chopped up or sold off for scrap, technology, or customers, which is a sad reality considering how inspiring AOL used to be. It is not a coincidence that successful entrepreneurs long for the early days. It is no accident that big companies talk about a return to basics. What they are alluding to is a time before the split, and they would be right. They do indeed need to return to a time when what they did was in perfect parallel to why they did it. If they continue down the path of focusing on their growth of what at the expense of why, more volume and less clarity, their ability to thrive and inspire for years to come is dubious at best. Companies like Walmart, Microsoft, Starbucks, The Gap, Dell, and so many others that used to be special have all gone through a split. If they cannot recapture their why and re-inspire those inside and outside their organization, every one of them will end up looking more like AOL than the companies they once were. What gets measured gets done. In the fall of her freshman year in college, Christina Harbridge set out to find a part-time job. Intrigued by the prospect of working in the antiques business, she answered a newspaper ad in Sacramento to do office work for a collector. Harbridge soon found out, however, that the job was filing papers for a collections agent. And even then, she wasn't entirely sure what that meant. The collections office consisted of a huge room with dozens of phone stations, each staffed with a debt collector making call after call to a long list of businesses and individuals who owed money. The setup of the room meant that there was no privacy. Everyone could hear everyone else's calls. Harbridge was immediately taken by the harshness of the tone that all the collectors used when talking to those from whom they aimed to collect unpaid debts. They would hound them and practically threaten them, she said. They would do anything it took to get information from them. Harbridge recognized that the owner of the company and the collectors were all kind, gracious people. They helped each other out, listened to each other's problems, and even joined together to sponsor a homeless family during the holidays. But when they were on the phone to collect a debt, these same people turned passive-aggressive, rude, and often mean. It was not because they were bad people. It's because they were incentivized to be that way. Their officious behavior made perfect sense. What gets measured gets done, as well-known sales coach Jack Daly says. And in the world of debt collecting, the callers were given bonuses based on how much money they collected. This has resulted in an entire industry that threatens, badgers, hounds, and provokes. It didn't take long until Harbridge found herself adopting the same attitude whenever she talked to the debtors. I began treating people on the phone the way everybody else in the office treated them, she said. Feeling like what she was doing was completely out of balance with her why, Harbridge decided there had to be another way. I got it in my head that I was going to start an agency that collected by being nice, she said. People in the collections business thought Harbridge naive, if not crazy. And maybe she was. In 1993, Harbridge moved to San Francisco and started her own collections firm, Bridgeport Financial. Steeped in the belief that agencies would have more success treating people with respect than badgering them, Harbridge built her company based on her why, that everyone has a story and everyone deserves to be listened to. Her approach was to have her agents try to establish a rapport with the debtor on the other end of the phone in the course of that 3-minute conversation. The goal was to learn everything they could about the person's circumstances. Did they have the means to pay the debt? Would they honor a payment plan? Was the reason for the failure to pay reflective of a short-term situation? We would get people to tell us the truth, she said. Sure, we had a legal department, but we tried to avoid using it. Harbridge knew, however, that no matter her intentions, if she measured the results the same way as everyone else, the same awful behavior would result. So she came up with an entirely new way to incentivize her people. She found a way to measure why. Bonuses were not given for the amount of money that was collected. They were given based on how many thank you cards her agents sent out. This is harder than it sounds. Sending out a card thanking someone for the time they spent talking on the phone requires a few things. First, Harbridge had to hire people who believed what she believed. She had to hire good fits. If her employees didn't believe that everyone deserves to be listened to, it wouldn't work. Only good fit hires would be capable of creating an environment on the phone that would actually warrant sending a thank you card, even though the purpose of the call was to ask for money. Harbridge measured why her company existed, not what they did, and the result was a culture in which compassion was valued above all. But what about the other results? What about her financial results and the ones most businesses pursue first? Well, Bridgeport Financial collected 300% more than the industry average. What's more, most of the people and companies who were initially being pursued ended up doing more business with the original company that sent the collections agency after them in the first place. This is almost unprecedented in the collections industry. Harbridge's business succeeded not just because she knew why she was doing what she was doing, but because she found a way to measure the why. The company's growth was loud and her cause was clear. She started with why and the rest followed. Most organizations today use very clear metrics to track the progress and growth of what they do. Usually it's money. Unfortunately, we have very poor measurements to ensure that a why stays clear. Dwayne Honoré has, for the past 10 years, run his own commercial construction company in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, a trade he learned from his father. A leader with a deep sense of purpose, he devised some years ago a brilliant system to ensure that his values are reinforced in his company's culture. He figured out how to measure something that most people only pay lip service to, work-life balance. Honoré believes that people should not spend all their time at work, but rather they should work to spend more of their time with their families. Every employee at Honoré Construction is required to clock in the morning and to clock out in the evening. But there's a catch. They must clock in between 8 and 8:30 a.m. and out by 5 and 5:30 p.m. Stay any later and they are taken out of the bonus pool. Because employees know they have to leave by 5:30 at the latest, wasted time has dropped to a minimum. Productivity is high and turnover is low. Consider how much you get done the day before you go on vacation. Now imagine every day is like that. That's what Dwayne Honoré figured out how to do. Because he figured out how to measure a value he holds dear, that value is embraced. More importantly, because Honoré's actions pass the salary test, others can clearly see what he believes. Money is a perfectly legitimate measurement of goods sold or services rendered, but it is no calculation of value. Just because somebody makes a lot of money does not mean necessarily that he or she provides a lot of value. Likewise, just because somebody makes a little money does not necessarily mean that he or she provides only a little value. Simply by measuring the number of goods sold or the money brought in is no indication of value. Value is a feeling, not a calculation. It is a perception. One could argue that a product with more bells and whistles that sells for less is the greater value. But by whose standard? My uncle used to make tennis rackets. His rackets were made in the exact same factory as a name brand racket. They were made of the same material on the same machine. The only difference was that when my uncle's rackets came off the assembly line, they didn't put the well-known brand logo on the product. My uncle's rackets sold for less money in the same big box retailer next to the name brand rackets. Month after month after month, the name brand rackets outsold the generic ones. Why? Because people perceived a greater value from the name brand rackets and felt just fine paying a premium for that feeling. On a strictly rational scale, the generic rackets offered better value. But again, value is a perception, not a calculation, which is the reason companies make such a big deal about investing in their brand. But a strong brand, like all the intangible factors that contribute to the perception of value, starts with a clear sense of why. If those outside the megaphone share your why, and if you're able to clearly communicate that belief in everything you say and do, trust emerges and value is perceived. When that happens, loyal buyers will always rationalize the premium they pay or the inconvenience they suffer to get that feeling. To them, the sacrifice of time or money is worth it. They will try to explain that their feeling of value comes from the quality or features or some other easy-to-point-to elements, but it doesn't. Those are external factors, and the feeling they get comes completely from inside them. When people can point to a company and clearly articulate what that company believes and use words unrelated to price, quality, service, and features, that is the proof that a company has successfully navigated the split. When people describe the value they perceive with visceral and excited terms like love, that is a sure sign that a clear sense of why exists. Good successions keep the why alive. There were three words missing from Bill Gates's goodbye speech when he officially left Microsoft in June 2008. They are three words he probably doesn't even realize need to be there. I'll be back. Although Gates abdicated his role as CEO to Steve Ballmer in 2000 so he could lend more time and energy to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, he still maintained a role and a presence at the Microsoft headquarters in Redmond, Washington. His plan was always to completely leave the company in the care of others, but, like a lot of founders, Gates forgot to do one thing that would allow his plan to work. This one oversight could have a devastating impact on Microsoft and may even require him to come back someday to right the ship he built. Bill Gates is special, not just because of his brain or his management style. Though important, those two things alone are not the formula for building a $60 billion corporation from scratch. Like all visionary leaders, Bill Gates is special because he embodies what he believes. He is the personification of Microsoft's why. And for that reason, he serves as a physical beacon, a reminder of why everyone comes to work. When Gates founded Microsoft with Paul Allen in 1975, he did so to advance a higher cause. If you give people the right tools and make them more productive, then everyone, no matter their lot in life, will have an opportunity to achieve their real potential. A PC in every home and on every desk, he envisioned. Remarkable from a company that didn't even make PCs. He saw the PC as the great equalizer. Microsoft's most successful software, Windows, allowed anyone to have access to powerful technology. Tools like Word, Excel, and PowerPoint gave everyone the power to realize the promise of a new technology, to become more efficient and more productive. Small businesses, for example, could look and act like big businesses. Microsoft's software helped Gates advance his cause to empower the everyman. Make no mistake, Microsoft has done more to change the world than Apple. Though we are drawn to Apple's well-deserved reputation for innovation and challenging the business models of more than one industry, it is Microsoft that was responsible for the advancement of the personal computer. Gates put a PC on every desk, and in doing so, he changed the world. As the physical embodiment of the company's why, the everyman who fulfilled an amazing potential, what happens now that he's gone? Gates himself has always held that he receives a disproportionate amount of attention for his role at Microsoft, much of it, of course, due to his exceptional wealth. Like all inspired leaders, he recognizes that his role is to lead the cause, but it is others who will be physically responsible for bringing that cause to life. Martin Luther King Jr. could not have changed America by walking across a bridge in Selma, Alabama, with five prominent civil rights leaders. It took the thousands of people marching behind them to spur change. Gates recognizes the need for people to produce the real change, but he neglected to remember that any effective movement, social or business, needs a leader to march in the front, preaching the vision and reminding people why they showed up in the first place. Though King needed to cross the bridge from Selma on his march to Montgomery, it was what it meant to cross the bridge that mattered. Likewise, in business, though profit and shareholder value are valid and essential destinations, they do not inspire people to come to work. Although Microsoft went through the split years ago, changing from a company that intended to change the world into a company that makes software, having Gates hang around helped Microsoft maintain at least a loose sense of why they existed. With Gates gone, Microsoft does not have sufficient systems to measure and preach their why anymore. This is an issue that will have exponential impact as time passes. Such a departure as Gates's is not without precedent among companies with equally visionary leaders. Steve Jobs, the physical embodiment of the rabble-rousing revolutionary, a man who also personifies his company's why, left Apple in 1985 after a legendary power struggle with Apple's president, John Sculley, and the Apple board of directors. The impact on Apple was profound. Originally hired by Jobs in 1983, Sculley was a perfectly capable executive with a proven track record. He knew what to do and he knew how to do things. He was considered one of the most talented marketing executives around, having risen quickly through the ranks at PepsiCo. At Pepsi, he was the one who created the wildly successful Pepsi Challenge taste test advertising campaign, leading Pepsi to overtake Coca-Cola for the first time. But the problem was, Sculley was a bad fit at Apple. He ran the company as a business and was not there to lead the cause. It's worth considering how such a bad fit as Sculley even got the job at Apple in the first place. Simple. He was manipulated. Sculley did not approach Jobs and ask to be part of Apple's cause. The way the real story unfolded made the fallout almost predictable. Jobs knew he needed help. He knew he needed a how guy to help him scale his vision. He approached Sculley, a man with a solid resume, and said, "Do you want to sell sugar water your whole life, or do you want to come change the world?" Playing off of Sculley's ego, aspirations, and fears, Jobs completed a perfectly executed manipulation. And with it, Jobs was ousted from his own company a few years later. Apple thrived on Steve Jobs' fumes for a few years as businesses started buying up Macintoshes and software developers continued to create new software. But it wouldn't be long until the company would begin to falter. Apple just wasn't what it used to be. It had gone through the split and ignored it. The why was getting fuzzier and fuzzier with each passing year. The inspiration was gone, literally. With a capable executive like Sculley running the business, there was no one to lead the cause. New products would be less revolutionary and more evolutionary, reported Fortune magazine at the time. Some people might even call them dull. Wary of Apple's right-brain ways, Sculley reorganized the company repeatedly, each time trying to get back what Apple had clearly lost. He brought in a new executive staff to help, but all they were doing was trying to manage how the company worked when it was the why that needed attention. Needless to say, morale was dismal. It wasn't until Jobs returned in 1997 that everyone inside and outside the company was reminded why Apple existed. With clarity back, the company quickly reestablished its power for innovation, for thinking different, and, once again, for redefining industries. With Jobs at the helm again, the culture for challenging the status quo, for empowering the individual, returned. Every decision was filtered through the why, and it worked. Like most inspiring leaders, Jobs trusted his gut over outside advice. He was regularly criticized for not making mass market decisions, such as letting people clone the Mac. He couldn't. Those actions violated what he believed. they failed the celery test. When the person who personifies the why departs without clearly articulating why the company was founded in the first place, they leave no clear cause for their successor to lead. The new CEO will come aboard to run the company and will focus attention on the growth of what with little attention to why. Worse, they may try to implement their own vision without considering the cause that originally inspired most people to show up in the first place. In these cases, the leader can work against the culture of the company instead of leading it or building upon it. The result is diminished morale, mass exodus, poor performance, and a slow and steady transition to a culture of mistrust and every man for himself. It happened at Dell. Michael Dell, too, had a cause when he started his company. From the start, he focused on efficiency as a way of getting more computing power into more hands. For him, it was about scale. Unfortunately, it was a cause that he, too, forgot and didn't communicate well enough before he stepped down as CEO in July of 2004. After the company started to weaken, customer service, for one, plummeted. He came back in less than 3 years. Michael Dell recognized that without him present to keep energy focused on the reason Dell was founded in the first place, the company became more obsessed with what at the expense of why. The company was too focused on the short term, and the balance of priorities was way too leaning toward things that deliver short-term results. That was the major root cause, Dell told the New York Times in September 2007. The company had become so dysfunctional, in fact, that some managers felt compelled to falsify earning reports between 2003 and 2006 in order to meet the sales targets, suggesting a corporate culture that put an undue pressure on managers to meet bottom-line targets. In the meantime, the company had missed significant market shifts, most notably the potential of the consumer electronics market. They also lost their edge with component suppliers as well. And, in 2006, Hewlett-Packard swept past Dell as the largest seller of PCs worldwide. Dell had gone through the split and failed to recognize the reason it wasn't the company it used to be. Starbucks is another good example. In 2000, Howard Schultz resigned as CEO of Starbucks, and for the first time in its history, and despite 50 million customers per week, the company started to crack. If you look back at the history of Starbucks, it thrived not because of its coffee, but because of the experience it offered its customers. It was Schultz who brought that why to the company when he arrived in 1982, 10 years after Gordon Bowker, Jerry Baldwin, and Zev Siegel first started selling coffee beans in Seattle. In the early days, it was about the coffee. Schultz, frustrated that the founders of Starbucks couldn't see the larger vision, set out to put the company on a new course, the course that ultimately turned Starbucks into the company we know today. Schultz had been enamored with the espresso bars of Italy, and it was his vision of building a comfortable environment between work and home, the third space, as he called it, that allowed Starbucks to single-handedly create a coffee shop culture in the United States that had until then only existed on college campuses. That was the time when Starbucks stood for something. It reflected an undying belief about the world. It was that idea that people bought, not the coffee. And it was inspiring. But Starbucks, like so many before it, went through the inevitable split. They, too, forgot about why the company was founded and started focusing on the results and the products. There was a time when Starbucks offered the option to sip your coffee out of a ceramic cup and eat your Danish off a ceramic plate. Two details that helped bring the company's belief to life in the place between work and home. But ceramic crockery is expensive to maintain, and Starbucks did away with it, favoring the more efficient paper cups. Though it saved money, it came at a cost. The erosion of trust. Nothing says to a customer, "We love you, now get out," like a paper cup. It was no longer about the third space. It had become about the coffee. Starbucks's why was going fuzzy. Thankfully, Schultz was there, the physical embodiment of the why, to remind people of the higher cause. But in 2000, he left, and things got worse. The company had grown from fewer than 1,000 stores to 13,000 in only 10 years. 8 years and two CEOs later, the company was dangerously overextended just as it was facing an onslaught of competition from McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts and other unexpected places. In a now-famous memo that Schultz wrote to his successor, Jim Donald, just months before returning to reclaim the helm, he implored Donald to make the changes necessary to evoke the heritage, the tradition, and the passion that we all have for the true Starbucks experience. The reason the company was floundering was not that it grew too fast, but that Schultz had not properly infused his why into the organization so that the organization could manage the why without him. In early 2008, Schultz replaced Donald with a leader who could better steer the company back to a time before the split, himself. None of these executives are considered God's gift to management. Steve Jobs's paranoia, for example, is well documented, and Bill Gates is socially awkward. Their companies are thousands of people deep, and they alone can't pull all the strings or push all the buttons to make everything work properly. They rely on the brains and the management skills of people, teams of people, to help them build their megaphones. They rely on people who share their cause. In this respect, they are no different from any other executive, but what they all have in common, something not all CEOs possess, is that they physically embody the cause around which they built their companies. Their physical presence reminds every executive and every employee why they showed up to work. Put simply, they inspire. Yet, like Bill Gates, these inspired leaders have all failed to properly articulate their cause in words that others could rally around in their absence. Failing to put the movement into hard words leaves them as the only ones who can actually lead the movement. What happens when Jobs or Dell or Schultz leave again? For companies of any size, success is the greatest challenge. As Microsoft grew, Gates stopped talking about what he believed and how he was going to change the world and started talking about what the company was doing. Microsoft changed. Founded as a company that believed in making people more productive so they could achieve their highest potential, Microsoft became a company that simply made software products. Such a seemingly subtle change affects behaviors. It alters decisions, and it impacts how a company structures itself for the future. Though Microsoft had changed since its founding, the impact was never as dramatic, because at least Bill Gates was there, the physical embodiment of the cause that inspired his executives and employees. Microsoft is just one of the tangible things that Gates has done in his life to bring his cause to life. The company is one of the what's to his own personal why. And now he's off to do something else that also embodies his cause, to use the Gates Foundation to help people around the world wake up every day to overcome obstacles so they too can have an opportunity to achieve their potential. The only difference is he's not doing it with software anymore. Steve Ballmer, a smart man by all accounts, does not physically embody Gates's vision of the world. He has the image of a powerful executive who sees numbers, competitors, and markets. He is a man with a gift for managing the what line. Like John Sculley at Apple, Jim Donald at Starbucks, and Kevin Rollins at Dell, all the CEOs who replaced the visionary founders or executives, Ballmer might be the perfect man to work alongside a visionary, but is he the perfect man to replace one? The entire culture of all these companies was built around one man's vision. The only succession plan that will work is to find a CEO who believes in and wants to continue to lead that movement, not replace it with their own vision of the future. Ballmer knows how to rally a company, but can he inspire it? Successful succession is more than selecting someone with an appropriate skill set. It's about finding someone who is in lockstep with the original cause around which the company was founded. Great second or third CEOs don't take the helm to implement their own vision of the future. They pick up the original banner and lead the company into the next generation. That's why we call it succession, not replacement. There is a continuity of vision. One of the reasons Southwest Airlines has been so good at succession is because its cause is so ingrained in its culture, and the CEOs who took over from Herb Kelleher also embodied the cause. Howard Putnam was the first president of Southwest after Kelleher. Though he was a career airline guy, it was not his resume that made him so well suited to lead the company. He was a good fit. Putnam recounts the time he met with Kelleher to interview for the job. Putnam leaned back in his chair and noticed that Kelleher had slipped his shoes off under his desk. More significantly, Putnam noticed the hole in one of Kelleher's socks. It was at that point that Putnam felt that he was the right man for the job. He loved that Kelleher was just like everyone else. He, too, had holes in his socks. Although Putnam felt Southwest was right for him, how do we know if he was right for Southwest? I had a chance to spend half a day with Putnam to talk. At one point in the afternoon, I suggested we take a break and grab a Starbucks. The mere suggestion incensed him. "I'm not going to Starbucks," he cracked. "I'm not paying $5 for a cup of coffee, and what the heck is a Frappuccino anyway?" It was at that point I realized how perfect a fit Putnam was for Southwest. He was an everyman, a Dunkin' Donuts guy. He was a perfect man to take the torch from Kelleher and charge forward. Southwest inspired him, and in the case of Howard Putnam, Kelleher hired somebody who could represent that cause, not reinvent it. Today, it has become so acculturated that it's almost automatic. The same could be said for Colleen Barrett, who became president of Southwest in 2001, some 30 years after she was working as Kelleher's secretary in his San Antonio law firm. By 2001, the company had nearly 30,000 employees and a fleet of 344 planes. By the time she took over, Barrett says that running the company had become a very collective effort. Kelleher stopped his day-to-day involvement in the company, but left a corporate culture so strong that his presence in the hallways was no longer needed. The physical person had largely been replaced by the folklore of Kelleher. But it is that folklore that has helped keep the why alive. Barrett freely admits she's not the smartest executive out there. She is self-deprecating in her personal assessment, in fact. But as the leader of the company, being the smartest was not her job. Her job was to lead the cause, to personify the values and remind everyone why they are there. The good news is, it will be easy to know if a successor is carrying the right torch. Simply apply the celery test and see if what the company is saying and doing makes sense. Test whether what they are doing effectively proves why they were founded. If we can't easily assess the company's why simply from looking at their product, services, marketing, and public statements, then odds are high that they don't know what it is either. If they did, so would we. When the why goes, what is all you have left? On April 5th, 1992, at approximately 8 in the morning, Walmart lost its why. On that day, Sam Walton, Walmart's inspired leader, the man who embodied the cause around which he built the world's largest retailer, died in the University of Arkansas Medical Science Hospital in Little Rock. He died of bone marrow cancer. Soon after, Walton's oldest son, S. Robeson Walton, who succeeded his father as chairman of the company, gave a public statement. "No changes are expected in the corporate direction, control, or policy," he said. Sadly for Walmart employees, customers, and shareholders, that's not what happened. Sam Walton was the embodiment of the everyman. Though he was named the richest man in America by Forbes magazine in 1985, a title he held until he died, he never understood the importance others placed on money. Certainly Walton was a competitor, and money was a good yardstick of success, but that's not what gave Walton or all those who worked at Walmart the feeling of success. It was people Walton valued above all else. People. "Look after people and people will look after you," was his belief, and everything Walton and Walmart did proved it. In the early days, for example, Walton insisted on showing up for work on Saturdays out of fairness to his store employees who had to work on weekends. He remembered birthdays and anniversaries, and even that a cashier's mother had just undergone gallbladder surgery. He chastised his executives for driving expensive cars and resisted using a corporate jet for many years. If the average American didn't have those things, then neither should those who are supposed to be their champions. Walmart never went through a split under Walton's command, because Walton never forgot where he came from. "I still can't believe it was news that I get my haircut at the barbershop. Where else would I get it?" he said. "Why do I drive a pickup truck? What am I supposed to haul my dogs around in, a Rolls Royce?" Often seen wearing his signature tweed jacket and a trucker's cap, Walton was the embodiment of those he aimed to serve. the average Joe American. With a company so beloved by employees, customers, and communities, Walton made only one major blunder. He didn't put his cause into clear enough words so that others could continue to lead that cause after he died. It's not entirely his fault. The part of the brain that controls the why doesn't control language. So, like so many, the best Walton could articulate was how to bring his cause to life. He talked about making products cheap, to make things more affordable to the average working American. He talked about building stores and rural communities so that the backbone of America's workforce didn't have to travel to the urban centers. It all made sense. All his decisions passed the celery test. It was the why upon which the company was built, however, that was left unsaid. Walton was involved in the company until just before his death, when his ailing health prevented him from participating any longer. Like all organizations with founder leaders whose physical presence helps keep the why alive, his continued involvement in the company had reminded everyone why they came to work every day. He inspired everyone around him. Just as Apple ran on the fumes of Steve Jobs for a few years just after he left the company, before the significant cracks started to show, so did Walmart remember Sam Walton and his why for a short time after he died. But as the why started to get fuzzier and fuzzier, the company changed direction. From then on, there would be a new motivation at the company, and it was something that Walton himself cautioned against: chasing money. Costco was co-founded in 1983 by Y-type Jim Senegal and How-type Jeffrey Brotman. Senegal learned about discount retailing from Sol Price, the same person from whom Sam Walton admitted to borrowing much of what he knew about the business. And, like Walton, Senegal believes in people first. "We're going to be a company that's on a first-name basis with everyone," he said in an interview on ABC's News Magazine Show 2020. Following the same formula as other inspiring leaders, Costco believes in looking after its employees first. Historically, they have paid their people about 40% more than those who work at Sam's Club, the Walmart-owned discount warehouse. And Costco offers above-average benefits, including health coverage for more than 90% of their employees. As a result, their turnover is consistently 5 times lower than Sam's Club. Like all companies built around a cause, Costco has relied on their megaphone to help them grow. They don't have a PR department, and they don't spend money on advertising. The law of diffusion is all that Costco needed to get the word out. Senegal recognizes the value of trust and loyalty of his employees over advertising and PR. So he says, "Imagine that you have 120,000 loyal ambassadors out there who are constantly saying good things about you." For years, Wall Street analysts criticized Costco's strategy of spending so much on their people instead of cutting costs to boost margins and help share value. Wall Street would have preferred the company to focus on what they did at the expense of why they did it. A Deutsche Bank analyst told Fortune magazine, "Costco continues to be a company that is better at serving the club member and the employee than the shareholder." Fortunately, Senegal trusts his gut more than he trusts Wall Street analysts. "Wall Street is in a business of making money between now and next Tuesday," he said in that 2020 interview. "We're in the business of building an organization, an institution that we hope will be here 50 years from now. And paying good wages and keeping people working with you is very good business." The amazing insight in all this is not just how inspiring Senegal is, but that almost everything he says and does echoes Sam Walton. Walmart got as big as it did doing the exact same thing, focusing on why and ensuring that what they did proved it. Money is never a cause, it is always a result. But on that fateful day, in April 1992, Walmart stopped believing in their why. Since Sam Walton's death, Walmart has been battered by scandals of mistreating their employees and customers, all in the name of shareholder value. Their why has gone so fuzzy that even when they do things well, few are willing to give them credit. The company, for example, was among the first major corporations to develop an environmental policy aimed at reducing waste and encouraging recycling. But Walmart's critics have grown so skeptical of the company's motives that the move was largely dismissed as posturing. Walmart has been working to improve its image and lighten its environmental impact for several years now, a column published in the New York Times website said on October 8, 2008. But Walmart is still selling consumerism even as it pledges to cut the social and environmental costs of making the stuff in its stores. Costco, on the other hand, was later than Walmart to announce its environmental policy, yet it has received a disproportionate amount of attention. The difference is that people believe it when Costco does it. When people know why you do what you do, they are willing to give you credit for everything that could serve as proof of your why. When they are unclear about your why, what you do has no context. Even though the things you do or decisions you make may be good, they won't make sense to others without a clear understanding of why. And what of the results? Still running on the memory of Sam Walton, Walmart's culture stayed intact at first, and the value of the two stocks was about even for a few years after Walton died. But as Walmart continued to run its business in a post-Sam, post-split manner, while Costco maintained clarity of why, the difference in value changed dramatically. An investment in Walmart on the day Sam Walton died would have earned a shareholder a 300% gain by the time this book was written. An investment made in Costco on the same day would have netted an 800% gain. Costco's advantage is that the embodiment of their why, Jim Senegal, is still there. The things he says and does help reinforce to all those around him what the company stands for. Staying true to that why, Senegal draws a $430,000 salary, a relatively small amount given the size and success of the company. At Walmart's peak, Sam Walton never took a salary of more than $350,000 per year himself, also consistent with what he believed. David Glass, the first man to take over as CEO after Sam Walton, and a man who spent considerable time around Sam Walton, said a lot of what goes on these days with high-flying companies and these overpaid CEOs who are really just looting from the top and aren't watching out for anybody but themselves, that really upsets me. It's one of the main things wrong with the American business today. Three more CEOs have attempted to carry the torch that Sam Walton lit. And with each succession, that torch, that clear sense of purpose, cause, and belief has grown dimmer and dimmer. The new hope lies in Michael T. Duke, who took over as CEO in early 2009. Duke's goal is to restore the luster and the clarity of Walmart's why. And to do it, he started by paying himself an annual salary of $5.43 million. Part 6. Discover Why. Chapter 13. The Origins of a Why. It started in Vietnam War-era Northern California, where anti-government ideals and disdain for large centers of power ran rampant. Two young men saw the power of government and corporations as the enemy, not because they were big per se, but because they squashed the spirit of the individual. They imagined a world in which an individual had a voice. They imagined a time when an individual could successfully stand up to incumbent power, old assumptions and status quo thoughts, and successfully challenge them, even redirect them. They hung out with hippie types who shared their beliefs, but they saw a different way to change the world that didn't require protesting or engaging in anything illegal. Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs came of age in this time. Not only was the revolutionary spirit running high in Northern California, but it was also the time and place of the computer revolution. And in this technology, they saw the opportunity to start their own revolution. The Apple gave an individual the power to do the same things as any company, Wozniak recounts. For the first time ever, Wozniak goes on, one person could take on a corporation simply because they had the ability to use technology. Wozniak engineered the Apple I and later the Apple II to be simple enough for people to harness the power of the technology. Jobs knew how to sell it. Thus was born Apple Computer, a company with a purpose. To give the individual, to give the dreamers and the idealists the power to challenge the status quo and succeed. But their cause, their why, started long before Apple was ever born. In 1971, working out of Wozniak's dorm room at UC Berkeley, the two Steves made something they called the Blue Box. Their little device hacked the phone system to give people the ability to avoid paying long-distance rates on their phone bills. Apple computers didn't exist yet, but Jobs and Woz were already challenging a Big Brother-type power, in this case, Ma Bell, American Telephone and Telegraph, the monopoly phone company. Technically, what the Blue Box did was illegal, and with no desire to challenge power by breaking the law, Jobs and Woz never actually used the device themselves. But they liked the idea of giving other individuals the ability to avoid having to play by the rules of monopolistic forces, a theme that would repeat many more times in Apple's future. On April 1, 1976, they repeated their pattern again. They took on the giants of the computer industry, most notably Big Blue, IBM. Before Apple, computing still meant using a punch card to give instructions to a huge mainframe squirreled away in a computer center somewhere. IBM targeted their technology to corporations and not, as Apple intended, as a tool for individuals to target corporations. With clarity of purpose and amazing discipline, Apple computers' success seemed to follow the law of diffusion, almost by design. In its first year in business, the company sold $1 million worth of computers to those who believed what they believed. By year two, they had sold $10 million worth. By their third year in business, they were a $100 million company, and they had attained billion-dollar status within only 6 years. Already a household name, in 1984, Apple launched the Macintosh with their famed 1984 commercial that aired during the Super Bowl. Directed by Ridley Scott, famed director of cult classics like Blade Runner, the commercial also changed the course of advertising. The first Super Bowl commercial was born. It ushered in the annual tradition of big-budget, cinematic Super Bowl advertising. With the Macintosh, Apple once again changed the tradition of how things were done. They challenged the standard of Microsoft's DOS, the standard operating system used by most personal computers at the time. The Macintosh was the first mass-market computer to use a graphical user interface and a mouse, allowing people to simply point and click rather than input code. Ironically, it was Microsoft that took Apple's concept to the masses with Windows, Gates's version of the graphical user interface. Apple's ability to ignite revolutions and Microsoft's ability to take ideas to the mass market perfectly illustrate the why of each company and indeed their respective founders. Jobs has always been about challenge, and Gates has always been about getting to the most people. Apple would continue to challenge with other products that followed the same pattern. Recent examples include the iPod, and more significantly, iTunes. With these technologies, Apple challenged the status quo business model of the music industry, an industry so distracted trying to protect its intellectual property and their outdated business model that it was busy suing 13-year-old music pirates while Apple redefined the online music market. The pattern repeated again when Apple introduced the iPhone. The status quo dictated that the cellular providers, not the phone manufacturer, decided the features and capability of the actual phones. T-Mobile, Verizon Wireless, and Sprint, for example, tell Motorola, LG, and Nokia what to do. Apple changed all that when they announced that with the iPhone, they would be telling the provider what the phone would do. Ironically, the company that Apple challenged with their Blue Box decades before, this time around, exhibited classic early adopter behavior. AT&T was the only one to agree to this new model, and so another revolution was ignited. Apple's keen aptitude for innovation is born out of its why. And save for the few years that Jobs was missing, it has never changed since the company was founded. Industries holding on to legacy business models should be forewarned. You could be next. If Apple stays true to their why, the television and movie industries will likely be next. Apple's ability to do what they do has nothing to do with industry expertise. All computer and technology companies have open access to talent and resources and are just as qualified to produce all the products that Apple does. It has to do with a purpose, cause, or belief that started many years ago with a couple of idealists in Cupertino, California. I want to put a ding in the universe, as Steve Jobs put it, and that's exactly what Apple does in the industries in which it competes. Apple is born out of its founder's why. There is no difference between one or the other. Apple is just one of the whats to Jobs's and Woz's why. The personality of Jobs and Apple are exactly the same. In fact, the personalities of all those who are viscerally drawn to Apple are similar. There is no difference between an Apple customer and an Apple employee. One believes in Apple's why and chooses to work for the company, and the other believes in Apple's why and chooses to buy its products. It is just a behavioral difference. Loyal shareholders are no different either. What they buy is different, but the reason they buy and remain loyal is the same. The products of the company become the symbols of their own identities. The diehards outside the company are said to be a part of the cult of Apple. The diehards inside the company are said to be a part of the cult of Steve. Their symbols are different, but their devotion to the cause is the same. That we use the word cult implies that we can recognize that there is deep faith, something irrational, that all those who believe share. And we'd be right. Jobs, his company, his loyal employees, and his loyal customers all exist to push the boundaries. They all fancy a good revolution. Just because Apple's why is so clear does not mean everyone is drawn to it. Some people like them and some people don't. Some people embrace them and some are repelled by them. But it cannot be denied. They stand for something. The law of diffusion says that only 2.5% of the population has the innovator mentality. They are the group of people willing to trust their intuition and take greater risks than others. Perhaps it's no coincidence that Microsoft Windows sits on 96% of the world's computers, whereas Apple maintains about 2.5%. Most people don't want to challenge the status quo. Although Apple employees will tell you that the company's success lies in its products, the fact is that a lot of companies make quality products. And though Apple's employees may still insist that their products are better, it depends on the standard by which you are judging them. Apple's products are indeed best for those who relate to Apple's why. It is Apple's belief that comes through in all that they think and all that they say and do that makes them who they are. They're so effective at it that they're actually able to clearly identify their own products simply by preceding the product name with the letter I. But they don't just own the letter I, they own the word I. They are a company that champions the creative spirit of the individual, and their products, services, and marketing simply prove it. The why comes from looking back. Conservative estimates put the numbers at 3-1. But some historians have said that the English army was outnumbered by 6-1. Regardless of which estimates you choose to believe, the prospects for Henry V, King of England, did not look good. It was late October in the year 1415, and the English army stood ready to do battle against a much bigger French force at Agincourt in northern France. But the numbers were just one of Henry's problems. The English army had marched over 250 miles. Taking them nearly 3 weeks, they had also lost 40% of their original numbers to sickness. The French, in stark contrast, were better rested and in much better spirits. The better trained and more experienced French were also excited at the prospect of exacting their revenge on the English to make up for the humiliation of previous defeats. And to top it all off, the French were vastly better equipped. The English were lightly armored, but whatever protection they did have was no match for the superior weight of French armor. But anyone who knows their medieval European history already knows the outcome of the Battle of Agincourt. Despite the overwhelming odds, the English won. The English had one vital piece of technology that was able to confound the French and start a chain of events that would ultimately result in a French defeat. The English had the longbow, a weapon with astounding range for its time. Standing far from the battlefield, far enough away that heavy armor was not needed, the English could look down into the valley and shower the French with arrows. But technology and range aren't what give an arrow its power. By itself, An arrow is a flimsy stick of wood with a sharpened tip and some feathers. By itself, an arrow cannot stand up to a sword or penetrate armor. What gives the arrow the ability to take on experience, training, numbers, and armor is momentum. That flimsy stick of wood, when hurtling through the air, becomes a force only when it is moving fast in one direction. But what does the Battle of Agincourt have to do with finding your why? Before it can gain any power or achieve any impact, an arrow must be pulled backward 180 degrees from the target. And that's also where a why derives its power. The why does not come from looking ahead at what you want to achieve and figuring out an appropriate strategy to get there. It is not born out of any market research. It does not come from extensive interviews with customers or even employees. It comes from looking in the completely opposite direction from where you are now. Finding why is a process of discovery, not invention. Just as Apple's why developed during the rebellious 1960s and 70s, the why for every other individual or organization comes from the past. It is born out of the upbringing and life experience of an individual or small group. Every single person has a why, and every single organization has one too. An organization, don't forget, is one of the what's, one of the tangible things a founder or group of founders has done in their lives to prove their why. Every company, organization, or group with the ability to inspire starts with a person or small group of people who are inspired to do something bigger than themselves. Gaining clarity of why, ironically, is not the hard part. It is the discipline to trust one's gut, to stay true to one's purpose, cause, or beliefs. Remaining completely in balance and authentic is the most difficult part. The few that are able to build a megaphone around their cause, and not just a company, are the ones who earn the ability to inspire. In doing so, they harness a power to move people that few can even imagine. Learning the why of a company or an organization, or understanding the why of any social movement, always starts with one thing: you. I am a failure. There are 3 months indelibly printed in my memory: September to December 2005. This was when I hit rock bottom. I started my business in February 2002, and it was incredibly exciting. I was full of piss and vinegar, as my grandfather would say. From an early age, my goal was to start my own business. It was the American dream, and I was living it. My whole feeling of self-worth came from the fact that I did it. I took the plunge, and it felt amazing. If anyone ever asked me what I did, I would pose like George Reeves from the old Superman TV series. I would put my hands on my hips, stick out my chest, and stand at an angle. With my head raised high, I'd declare, I am an entrepreneur. What I did was how I defined myself, and it felt good. I wasn't like Superman. I was Superman. As anyone who starts a business knows, it is a fantastic race. There is a statistic that hangs over your head. Over 90% of all new businesses fail in the first 3 years. For anyone with even a bit of a competitive spirit in them, especially for someone who defines himself or herself as an entrepreneur, hands on hips, chest out, standing at an angle, these overwhelming odds of failure are not intimidating. They only add fuel to the fire. The foolishness of thinking that you're part of a small minority of those who actually will make it past 3 years and defy the odds is part of what makes entrepreneurs who they are, driven by passion and completely irrational. After year one, we celebrated. We hadn't gone out of business. We were beating the odds. We were living the dream. 2 years passed, then three. I'm still not sure how we did it. We never properly implemented any good systems and processes. But to heck with it, we'd beaten the odds, and I had achieved the goal, and that's all that mattered. I was now a proud member of a very small group of people who could say, with statistical proof, that I was an American small business owner. The fourth year would prove to be very different. The novelty of being an entrepreneur had worn off. I no longer stood like George Reeves. When asked what I did, I would now tell people that I did positioning and strategy consulting. It was much less exciting, and it certainly didn't feel like a big race anymore. It was no longer a passionate pursuit. It was just a business. And the reality was that the business did not look that rosy. We were never a runaway success. We made a living, but not much.